At this hour, a sold-out audience is assembling at the National Constitution Center to learn about the work and workings of our currently comprised U.S. Supreme Court, all from Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, co-author of the new book entitled Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. I had the chance to speak with Mr. Tribe earlier today in studio, as he also appeared on Radio Times with Marty Moscowane. Mr. Tribe, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
Mr. Tribe, John Roberts was a student of yours at Harvard. In fact, all nine justices have either a Harvard or Yale Law School pedigree. Is this a more homogeneous body than previous Supreme Court nonets?
I think so. I mean, you put your finger, Dave, on a really big problem. I mean, the idea that all nine justices went to Harvard or Yale is honestly an outrage. I mean, I've got nothing against Harvard. I love it. I've taught there for over 40 years, and I've got nothing against Yale. But, you know, University of California, Penn, Ohio State, Texas, there are a lot of places where wonderful people have gone to law school, and there are lots of careers that ought to lead people onto the court. I mean, sometimes governors like Earl Warren, who also had been an attorney general, get onto the court. Attorney General Robert Jackson, attorney general of the U.S., became a great justice. Hugo Black, a U.S. senator, became a great justice. William O. Douglas, who had been head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. But we don't have anybody like that now. We have nobody who knows what it's like to face the people directly and to be held accountable by them. And I think that's a great gap in experience.
Ilana Kagan is singular in that she's the only one to have not previously worn a judicial robe.
That's right. She was Solicitor General and she was Dean of the Harvard Law School, which is kind of a political job in a way, junior varsity politics. But all eight of the others have been out in the farm teams, basically, most of them in a U.S. Court of Appeals and many of them in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. Now, that's good training for a lot of the issues that justices have to deal with, but it's certainly not enough, and it doesn't bring enough diversity to the court. And diversity matters because the answers to the questions that the court has to grapple with are not to be found in the sky somewhere, and they're not to be read in some secret document that deciphers the abstract language of the Constitution. When the Constitution says equal protection of the laws, does it mean treating everybody identically? You know, the way Anatole France talked about the majestic equality of French law that condemns rich and poor alike by forbidding them all to sleep under the bridges of Paris and beg in the streets. That's identical treatment, but it's not equal treatment. When you pay special attention to the racial background and experience of somebody in order to create a more integrated environment, is that a denial of equal protection or is that a realization of equal protection? The Constitution doesn't really answer that question. Certainly, its language doesn't answer it. Even its history doesn't answer it. And so you want people to bring different life experiences to the challenging process of deciphering our history and interpreting our values and interpreting the language of a document as often open-ended as the Constitution is.
So with that, to what extent do you feel it's incumbent on the president to take inventory of the currently comprised court and then work to nominate someone who will bring a different sort of ideas or diversity to it?
I think it's very important. I think that's why it was a good thing that Bill Clinton took seriously the possibility of having different kinds of people. He offered the position of a Supreme Court justice to Mario Cuomo, who I think probably to this day regrets that he didn't accept it, and also to Secretary of the Interior Babbitt. I mean, he was looking for different kinds of people. He ended up with two very good people, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, but not as different from the existing norm as they might have been. I think that presidents now are less willing to take risks. Now that so much is so obviously at stake in terms of decisions that will shape all of our lives about sex, about love, about marriage, about guns, about speech, you know, the court has its finger in every pie that you can see all the way to the horizon. And now that that's clear, and because it's clear that the way justices look at issues will have a powerful effect on how they vote, presidents are more inclined to pick people who have a kind of track record in the executive branch where others have gotten to know their philosophies and in the lower courts. It's a little misleading Occasionally, they goof. I mean, the presidents who appointed Stevens and Souter, like Eisenhower, who appointed Warren and Brennan, didn't get exactly what they imagined they might get. But now that people are focused like lasers on picking only people whose backgrounds are close to the White House and known by the White House, people like Elena Kagan, there's a less likelihood that they're going to get the kind of diversity that I think would be helpful.
Is that caution on the part of the president forever changed in part based on the nominating experiences of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas?
It could well be. Could well be. Certainly the Robert Bork experience was a transformative one. It helped to politicize the process. I've sometimes been blamed for it, although I honestly think that Bork did himself in by the kind of testimony that he gave when he seemed pretty scary to a lot of people. But I testified for a few hours, and a lot of Republicans made it clear that since I was testifying against him, there would be payback, and they would never vote to confirm me to a position like that.
Okay, you mentioned the term farm team a moment ago. Nine, of course, the number of players on the field in baseball, and there are ample baseball references in this book.
Right. I mean, baseball is pervasive. The Chief Justice used the image of the umpire famously during his confirmation hearings when he said that, like a good umpire, he was just going to call balls and strikes. And I talk about how oversimplistic that is. Obviously, even an umpire has to make judgment calls about the strike zone. One umpire famously said that the strike zone is a living, breathing document, much like some people describe the Constitution as being. But there is a really big difference that I think is hidden by the way that Roberts described the role, and that is at least umpires don't make the rules. They apply a set of rules. Nobody who is serious about the law and the Supreme Court fails to realize that justices make the rules of constitutional law. They're not handed to them on tablets from Mount Sinai or from Mount Vernon. They make those rules. The Constitution, for example, says that the government can't deprive you of liberty without due process of law. Well, what does that imply for bodily liberty, for the liberty of reproduction, for freedom of thought, for a lot of things that aren't expressly mentioned in the Constitution? You have to make rules to deal with situations like that. What does it imply for whether evidence that is taken by invading your expectations of privacy but without breaking into your home is used to convict you? Is that evidence admissible or not? That's a result of a judge-made rule. When you try to sue government agents for snooping on you in violation of what you believe is your right to privacy, do you have a right to get damages? Or are they immune? Those are rules that the courts make. So they're not just umpires.
And indeed, many of the cases that are talked about in the book, be it healthcare, Citizens United, District of Columbia versus Heller, these are key cases. And part of what we learn is some of the consequences and rollout can't be anticipated. And even at this juncture, we don't know how it will play.
That's right. I mean, we have to live with that uncertainty. Part of what I argue in the book is that all these certitudes that people have, people are certain that they're just a bunch of politicians. They're certain that they vote their preferences. They're certain that this or that. Those certitudes are just phony. They prevent us from understanding better and predicting better what the court is likely to do in various areas. And we have to live with a degree of uncertainty because justice itself is uncertain.
Hence the title.
Hence the title.
Uncertain Justice. And it was interesting to learn that even Roe v. Wade might have ultimately worked against those who believed in reproductive rights.
Well, there was a backlash to some extent to Roe v. Wade, and Justice Ginsburg, who is a fan of reproductive rights, who believes they're in the Constitution, thought the court would have done better to move a step at a time, a little more slowly, less dramatically. But in the case where the Supreme Court, a case from Pennsylvania actually, Planned Parenthood of Pennsylvania versus Casey in 1992, when the Supreme Court reaffirmed the core holding of Roe v. Wade, turns out that that case came awfully close to going the other way. But it was just some last-minute thought on the part of several justices that led them to reaffirm Roe v. Wade. Brown v. Board almost went the other way. There's definite evidence that there was a 5-4 vote that would have reaffirmed Plessy versus Ferguson and held that separate but equal is still the law of the land. But when Chief Justice Vincent died of a heart attack in the middle of the term and Earl Warren became the Chief Justice, everything changed, And Felix Frankfurter famously said to some of his colleagues, "It was the sudden death of Chief Justice Vincent that convinced me finally that there is a God."
There's a public perception that this is a 5-4 split court, though you are quick to note that actually, no, these are 9 individuals, and there are plenty of surprises in how they rule and how often the swing voter, Anthony Kennedy, rules on a given case.
Right. And though you might call him the swing voter, when it's 5-4, any one of the 5 could make a different decision. And sometimes, I mean, there was a 5-4 decision striking down a regulation in Vermont that was designed to lower drug prices and make pharmaceutical products more readily available to people without lots of money. It was struck down 5-4. One of the votes to strike it down was Sotomayor. And Breyer was one of the dissenters. The other so-called liberals were on the dissenting side, thinking that Sotomayor was really turning the clock back to the pre-1937 days when the Supreme Court made it very hard to get economic regulations through and to get them passed. So the 5-4s don't tell you very much. And the fact is that the court has been closely divided even in earlier years when it presented a united face to the country. Even the early Supreme Court under the great Chief Justice John Marshall often had internal divisions, but he managed to get all the justices to go along with a unanimous opinion for the majority. And it was Chief Justice Stone, Harlan Fiske Stone, who had been dean of Columbia Law School, who dramatically changed things by saying that when we're divided, we should be candid about it. We should let it all hang out because people can only learn from understanding where our differences lie. That will give them a better compass for the future. And so I tend to be in favor of the open airing of disagreement and debate and dispute. Although a lot of people say it brings the court into disrepute, I think that's a mistake. It can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If enough people say that it's too political a court, look at all the 5-4s, then more people will believe that, and I think that's too bad.
It is, precisely because the inner workings of the court are still shrouded in mystery and secrecy, that it makes the public even more fascinated to learn what they can about
right.
how it goes
and
down.
I think one antidote to that would be to let TV cameras into the courtroom during the argument. I'd be all in favor of that.
Do you think that'll happen in your lifetime?
Probably not. A lot of the justices say it'll happen over their dead bodies. So I don't know. And a lot of them are younger than I am.
Looking out, this is a busy year for the court. Every year, you could argue, has busy things on the docket. What is it? Some 8,000 petitions are brought before
about
the court, 8, and less than 1% of them are actually heard.
That's right. About 8,000 requests for a hearing called petitions for certiorari. All these legal terms I try to avoid using in the book. And of those, they typically actually hear argument only in 75 to 80. When I clerked at the court back in the prehistoric era in the late 1960s, there were only about 5,000 requests, and we granted about 150 of them. The court has heard less and less cases.
But I thought the computer age was supposed to make us more efficient.
Well, it certainly makes the opinions longer. Makes it easier to write them on these, on iPads and iPhones.
Is it possible to look into a crystal ball and make some sense based on what we've learned in the first decade, how that Roberts Court will proceed?
Well, issue by issue, it may be possible. I mean, for example, before and after the oral argument in the Obamacare decision before the court, I was watching closely and I knew Roberts and I figured and said publicly that I thought he would cast the decisive vote to uphold the individual mandate and to do it on the basis of the government's taxing power. A lot of people thought I was crazy. It's possible. I don't claim to have a crystal ball on everything, but I do think that some things are predictable.
Another student of yours is another famous one, Barack Obama.
He was one hell of a research assistant. I knew that I was lucky to have somebody really brilliant when he was working for me. I can't pretend that I knew he would become president, but I knew he would become something really important.
His term is running down. Will he have an opportunity, do you think, to nominate another Supreme Court justice?
No. I mean, whether or not there's a vacancy, I think everybody realizes that our politics now is so poisonous that no one who would have the kinds of views that he would find acceptable on the court would be acceptable to the current Senate. And the filibuster,
Elena Kagan included?
Well, I don't think anybody could be confirmed now. Anybody. I don't think God could be confirmed to the Supreme Court.
Mr. Tribe, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight. Lawrence Tribe, Harvard Law Professor and co-author of the new book entitled Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution.